watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Finner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton-Bealeton, or WMRW, Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm your host, Lynn Gary. There's very little about our society which is natural, and by that I mean based on some universal and unchangeable principle, as for example, gravity, or the length of days relative to latitude and season. Human society is built on ideas at the most basic level. Ideas about human nature and intelligence, the natural world and our place in it, what is valuable, what is right, and who is qualified to decide. When these fundamental assumptions are widely accepted as true, they appear natural, normal, inevitable, not as the arbitrary customs they in fact are. Our social institutions reflect and perpetuate this consensus reality in large and small ways, and changing our ideas leads to changes in our institutions. That is why people determined to maintain a status quo battle to control the institutional vectors of reality creation, schools, the media, and even religion. A prime example of this is the question of the corporation. Corporation is a legal construct that has been attributed personhood under law and now enjoys more freedom and power than actual persons. The same society that created corporations is now ruled by them. Our first speaker, David Corton, is publisher of Yes Magazine and author of several books, including When Corporations Rule the World, The Post-Corporate World, Life After Capitalism, and his most recent, The Great Turning, From Empire to Earth Community. Corton has an interesting background for a critic of corporate globalization. U.S. Air Force Intelligence, an MBA and PhD from Stanford Business School, time as faculty at Harvard Business School, and a 15-year stint in Asia for the Ford Foundation and the U.S. Agency for International Development. His experience in conventional economic development institutions led him to conclude these models created misery rather than alleviated it as they claimed to. Here's David Corton speaking at a conference on reclaiming the media.
I want to start by thanking Reclaim the Media, the Unitarian Church, and of course Yes Magazine for sponsoring this event, which is a very timely part of their effort to bring an end to empire and to birth a world of truly democratic societies. Now, I assume that you're all here because you're committed to this goal of ending empire and birthing a new world of Earth communities. Can I be confident in that? Great. Now, a goal that is shared by Alternative Radio, Reclaim the Media, and Yes Magazine is to one day make independent media the mainstream media and to brand the corporate media for what it is, a media of, by, and for big business. So I want you to all be careful and watch your language when you talk about media. We don't talk about alternative media, and when we speak about mainstream media, the other guys are actually corporate media, not mainstream media. So I hope we get all that clear. So we're here tonight to talk about empire. Now, empire is a term that was pretty much out of vogue in the 1990s when most of us were focused on the resistance against corporate globalization. Now everybody's talking about empire. So what happened? Well, following the terrorist attack of September 11, 2001, of course, the United States government announced its intention to use the full force of U.S. military power to impose order on the world and secure U.S. interests. Foreign policy analysts and pundits actually began using the term empire quite openly as they debated the merits of the U.S. pursuing an explicit policy of imperial domination a la the Roman Empire. Now, it's interesting the implications. Corporate-led globalization has a history of roughly 400 years, going back to the chartering of the British East India Corporation. Empire has a rather longer history of some 5,000 years. And in its hubris, by proudly embracing the label of empire, our nation's ruling establishment stripped away the veil of illusion of U.S. democracy and global benevolence and drew attention to the troubling truth that our country, from its founding, has been an imperial nation ruled as a plutocracy by a wealthy elite. Our Constitution, of course, was written by white male landowners, and if you read it carefully in the context of the time, it was written to enshrine their power. The land we occupy was, of course, taken by force and deceit from Native Americans. Much of that land was subsequently worked by slaves. Women didn't get the vote until 1920. The current assault on democracy by those in power is nothing new. In the words of Francis Moore LePay, to save the democracy we thought we had, we must take it to where it has never been. Now, as I assume you're all familiar, the preamble to the Earth Charter, the Citizen Declaration of Interdependence, begins with these prophetic words. We stand at a critical moment in Earth's history, a time when humanity must choose its future. Now, the actions of the U.S. government following the 9/11 attack helped to clarify the nature and the significance of the choice before us and to illuminate a path to a unifying political agenda designed to actualize what many of us long believed to be foundational American values. Now, for 5,000 years, the dominant human societies have organized relationships at all levels, from those among states to those among family members, by dominator hierarchy. We call that the era of empire. And that era has now reached the limits of exploitation that people and planet will tolerate. If we continue business as usual, future generations are likely to look back and refer to our time as the time of the great unraveling, the time of social and environmental collapse. Fortunately, we have a choice. It is within our means to turn away from the era of empire and to bring forth instead a new era of Earth community, grounded in a mature understanding of our responsibilities to one another and to Earth. Buddhist spiritual teacher Joanna Macy suggests that if we are successful, future generations may speak of our time as the time of the great turning. Now, for hundreds of thousands of years before the onset of empire, humans evolved within a cultural and institutional frame of Earth community. They organized not to dominate life, but to celebrate it. These early human societies worshiped the goddess, balanced the feminine and masculine energies, placed women in significant leadership roles, and were generally peaceful and egalitarian. Then some 5,000 years ago, our ancestors made a tragic turn to the way of domination. The masculine drove out the feminine as men took over to rule by bow and sword in a brutal competition for power that created a relentless play-or-die, rule-or-die dynamic of violence and oppression as the power-driven and ethically challenged fought to death for the privileges of absolute power. Resources were diverted away from meeting the needs of people and nature to supporting the military forces, prisons, palaces, temples, retainers, and propagandists on which the system of imperial domination depends. Conquest became a measure of greatness. It began in Mesopotamia, of course, the land we now call Iraq. Empire has come full circle, as this is the land in which the most powerful of all empires, and hopefully the last empire, appears destined to exhaust itself. Now, thinking about the implications of this 5,000 years, it is axiomatic. For a few to be on the top, the many must be on the bottom. The primary function of imperial institutions is not, in fact, to improve the conditions of human life, but rather to secure the power and privilege of those on top against the wrath of those consigned to conditions of literal or virtual slavery at the bottom. Racism, sexism, classism, and environmental devastation are all manifestations of this dynamic of empire and the quest for imperial power. Now, during the course of empire's 5,000-year history, its primary institutional form has regularly morphed. First, the city-states of ancient times morphed then to the nation-states of more modern times, and then most recently morphed to the imperial corporations of our time. The underlying pattern of domination and exclusion, however, remains to this day largely unchanged. So does empire, and so too remains empire's signature pattern of rule by the power driven and ethically challenged. You may have noticed. It is time to put the era of empire behind us. The starting point in this work is remarkably simple and frames an important mission for the independent media. We humans live by the stories that shape our cultures. The real power of empire resides less in its capacity for physical force than in its ability to control the cultural stories by which we define our nature and the pathway to prosperity, security, and meaning. Consider how the familiar stories, contemporary stories of empire, affirm the relationships of domination in our time. So I'm going to briefly summarize these three stories. The imperial prosperity story says that an eternally growing economy benefits everyone. To grow the economy, we need wealthy people who can invest in enterprises that create jobs. Thus, for the good of society, we must free wealthy people from the taxes and regulations that limit their ability to accumulate great wealth. We must also eliminate welfare programs that strip away the incentive for the poor to be productive members of society willing to work hard at whatever wages the market offers. The imperial security story. This story tells of a dangerous world filled with criminals, terrorists, and foreign enemies who must be controlled or removed from society by strong police and military forces. And we must, of course, invest the resources in our society to this end. And the imperial meaning story tells of a God who instructs us to go forth to establish dominion over the earth, rewards the righteous with wealth and power, and evokes divine punishment on sinners by consigning them to lives of poverty. Salvation is to be found in obedience to God and his appointed representatives. Now, have any of you ever heard any of these stories? It's very important that we come to be conscious of these stories and their implications and where they come from, for what purpose. Because they affirm the legitimacy, even the sacred purpose, of economic inequality, the use of physical force to maintain imperial power, and the special righteousness of the ruling elite. Now, whose purpose would that serve? Now, although it may seem absurdly simple, the key to changing the course of the human future is to expose the imperial stories for what they are, as we simultaneously seek to infuse into the mainstream culture the stories of the possibilities of Earth community and the positive potentials of our human nature. This process of interjecting these new stories, of course, is the defining mission of Yes Magazine. This particular historical moment is a particularly opportune moment to bring new stories to the fore. We're finding a perfect economic storm is breaking onto our shores, born of a convergence of peak oil, climate change, and a meltdown of the U.S. dollar, together presenting irrefutable evidence that the old stories are not working, that the stories of empire are not working, because these are the stories that led us to this condition. Peak oil, of course, occurs when oil production peaks and begins its inexorable decline in the face of prices heading for the sky. Peak oil may have arrived last year. It may not arrive until 10 years in the future, perhaps. But it makes no difference. Oil-dependent transportation and global supply chains, auto-dependent suburbia, strip malls and box stores like Walmart located in the middle of nowhere, oil-dependent industrial agriculture, even the military hardware we use to secure our access to cheap oil, all of these are becoming unsustainable relics of a dying era, and we must act immediately to eliminate our dependence on oil. Now, the consequences of peak oil will be exacerbated by the growing devastation of climate change. During the 1950s, our planet averaged 24 severe weather events per year. Got that number, 24 per year. During the first 5 years of the current decade, that average was 350 per year. From 24 per year to 350 per year within the lifetimes of most of us in this room. Hurricanes Katrina and Rita are but a foretaste of what lies ahead. According to a U.S. Department of Defense study, we can expect shorter growing seasons and a 10 to 25% loss of crop yield. Water shortages, an increase in forest fires, famine, disease, severe weather events, endemic resource wars, and uncontrolled migration. The third element of the perfect economic storm, the meltdown of the U.S. dollar, is the consequence of a growing U.S. trade deficit, which in 2005 hit $750 billion and growing. Now, this, of course, is a measure of the extent to which we in the United States are living ever further beyond our own means, running up a credit card debt to the rest of the world and leaving the bill to our children. Growth in the trade deficit is a measure of the rate at which we are hemorrhaging both family wage jobs that created the U.S. middle class and the manufacturing, technology, and research capabilities that go with those jobs. Now, on the day the rest of the world tires of selling on credit to an economic deadbeat, the financial house of cards that supports our profligate ways will collapse. Now, as these events converge, the interesting part. The economic incentives will shift dramatically from global to local supply chains and from suburban sprawl to compact communities. And the communities that fare best will be those that act now to become substantially self-reliant in such things as food and energy. Now, this is where the crisis becomes an opportunity. Because as the perfect economic storm unfolds, it will compel us to rebuild functioning communities, restore a sense of place, democratize economic power, and radically revise our priorities for the use of labor, land, and other natural resources to give first priority to people and nature. Okay, so what is the underlying theme of the new stories of Earth Community? Well, it's not really very complicated when you get down to it. And I suspect if we opened this up for discussion, you'd all come to it yourselves very quickly. True prosperity, security, and meaning are found in vibrant, caring, interlinked communities that support every person in realizing the fullness of their humanity. I suggest the radical idea that we forget about economic growth. If we were to instead concentrate on growing strong and healthy families, communities, and natural systems, prosperity, security, and meaning would naturally and inevitably follow. Now, here is a critical point I want to leave with you in closing. There is a far greater readiness in these United States to accept a new story than we might first assume. I have a question for you. Would you believe that there is any major question on which 90% of Americans agree? How many could name one quickly? I got two people, but I bet you know the answer. A recent poll reported that 90% of Americans agree that big companies have too much power. Now, boy, is that ever a useful starting point. Second, 83% of us believe that as a society, the United States is focused on the wrong priorities. Anybody here disagree with that? Okay, we're all on the same boat. Supermajorities of Americans of more than 80% want greater priority given to children, family, community, and a healthy environment. So, okay, are we out of step with the rest of America? No. No. This is a very important starting point. And also note, none of these are distinctively conservative or liberal values. Rather, they are widely shared human values that provide a natural foundation for a new majoritarian political alliance that can bring our nation together in common cause and put it on a positive course. Now, the other side of this picture, of course, is that there are right-wing extremists out there committed to an elite imperial rule, and they have claimed the mantle of conservative family values to advance an agenda that is far from conservative and actually constitutes a literal war against children, families, communities, democracy, nature. In short, all the values most all Americans share. Their favored policies, as we should be well aware, drive down wages and benefits for working people, which forces parents to take on multiple jobs paying less than a family wage that leave no time for child care or community participation. They roll back regulations that protect the health and safety of children, family, communities, and the environment, thus allowing the discharge into our air and water of toxins destructive of our health and of our children's physical and mental development. They place quality education, health care, housing, and retirement beyond the reach of most Americans. They give free rein to corporate lobbyists to buy political favors in defiance of the will and well-being of average Americans. They allow corporations tax breaks for billions of dollars spent each year on direct marketing to children to promote violent video games and to create lifetime addictions to junk food, alcohol, and cigarettes. Well, so who's out of step with America? Now, these are the stories that we've got to get out there. We've got to learn the framing. We've got to learn how to get beyond just individual issues and fight and battles and identity politics to begin to frame these larger stories in terms of majoritarian politics. It is a political no-brainer. Let us celebrate the values that bring us together. Expose the reality of the far right's war against children, family, community, democracy, and nature. And tell the stories of the opportunity at hand to mobilize the nation behind a comprehensive national agenda with what most of us have longed to believe, aligned with what most of us have long believed, to be our defining national values. Now, needless to say, the leadership in exposing the old stories and framing the new stories is not likely to come from the corporate media. It obviously requires the focused attention of a strong and vital independent media. So in these turbulent and frightening times, it is important to remind ourselves that we're privileged to live at the most exciting moment of opportunity in the whole of the human experience. The future is in our hands. Now is the hour. We have the power. We are the ones we've been waiting for. Thank you.
That was Dr. David Corton, author of The Great Turning, From Empire to Earth Community. He has a website, davidcorton.org. Corton is spelled K-O-R-T-E-N. The Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, CELDEF, has been on the legal front lines of challenging corporate rights in favor of environmental health and democracy and self-determination for communities. CELDEF has been pressing forward to create a competing right to corporate rights, that is, rights for nature, and the right of humans to act within the legal system on behalf of nature. On September 19th, the borough of Tamaqua in Pennsylvania became the first municipality in the United States to legally recognize the rights of nature. The borough council unanimously passed a law declaring that mining and dredge corporations possess no constitutional rights within the borough. Tamaqua thus becomes the fifth local government in the country to abolish the so-called rights and privileges claimed by corporations since the Supreme Court declared them persons under law in the 19th century. Since then, corporations have used those legally created rights to nullify local laws designed to protect the integrity of communities. The Tamaqua Law also bans corporations from engaging in the land application of sewage sludge within the borough, recognizes that ecosystems in Tamaqua possess enforceable rights against corporations, asserts that corporations doing business in Tamaqua will henceforth be treated as state actors under the law, and thus be required to respect the rights of people and natural communities within the borough, and establishes that Tamaqua residents can bring lawsuits to vindicate not only their own civil rights, but also the newly mandated rights of nature. In the ordinance, the borough council also declared that if state and federal agencies or corporate managers attempt to invalidate the ordinance, a borough-wide public meeting would be hosted to determine additional steps to expand local control and self-governance within the borough. Ben Price, the project's director for CELDEF, which helped draft the ordinance, declared that the Tamaqua Borough Council has taken an extraordinary but logical step. Since this nation's founding and for centuries before, law in the Western world has treated rivers, mountains, forests, and other natural systems as property with no rights that governments or corporations must respect. This has resulted in the destruction of ecosystems and natural communities, backed by law, public policy, and the power of government. Richard Grossman, the Legal Defense Fund's historian, pointed out that the work in Tamaqua Borough has several parallels to prior people's movements, such as the abolitionists, who struggled over decades to undo constitutional law, which had long defined certain people as property, and to transform this nation's property and commerce constitution into a rights and liberty constitution. The Tamaqua Ordinance emerged out of 6 months of discussion and debate across Tamaqua Borough and Schuylkill County. Democracy schools, presented by the Legal Defense Fund along with public meetings hosted by local governments and community groups, laid the groundwork for the Borough Council to overturn years of collusion between the Pennsylvania legislature, state environmental agencies, and corporate polluters focused on denying the rights of people within Tamaqua. Helping to drive the campaign was the Army for a Clean Environment, a 1,000-member Schuylkill County citizen organization led by Dr. Dante Picciano. In the coming months, other municipalities in Schuylkill County are expected to follow Tamaqua's lead. Municipalities across Pennsylvania are considering similar ways of equipping their citizens with the legal authority to stop corporate assaults engineered by mining, sludge, and factory farm corporations. Assaults enabled and protected by state permitting agencies and courts. CELDEF, which is based in Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, has worked with communities resisting corporate assaults upon democratic self-governance since 1995. With their help, over 100 Pennsylvania municipalities have adopted ordinances challenging corporate rights in favor of the environment. CELDEF has also brought its program of democracy schools to communities in Pennsylvania and 25 other states, including New York, in order to give people the tools to end destructive corporate acts routinely permitted by state and federal agencies. New York's next democracy school will be held October 20th through 22nd in Yates County on the west side of Seneca Lake. To find out more locally, contact Jack Ossent at area code 607-243-7262, 243-7262, or email sandhill1, that's sandhill and the number 1, at frontiernet.net, or visit the CELDEF website and click on Democracy Schools. That's celdef.org. CELDF.org, or you can access that link through our website at unwelcomeguests.org.
You noble diggers all, stand up now, stand up now. You noble diggers all, stand up now. The wasteland to maintain, seen cavaliers by name. Your digging does maintain, and persons all defame. Stand up now, stand up now. Your houses they pull down, stand up now, stand up now. Your houses they pull down, stand up now. Your houses they pull down to fright your men in town, but the gentry must come down and the poor shall wear the crown. Stand up now, diggers all. With spades and hoes and ploughs, stand up now, with spades and hoes and ploughs, stand up now. Your freedom to uphold, seen cavaliers are bold, to kill you if they could, and rights from you to hold, stand up now, diggers all. The gentry are all round, stand up now, stand up now. The gentry are all round, stand up now. The gentry are all round, on each side they are found, their wisdom so profound, to cheat us of our ground. Stand up now, stand up now. The lawyers they conjoin, stand up now, the lawyers they conjoin, stand up now. To arrest you they advise, such fury they devise, the devil in them lies, and hath blinded both their eyes. Stand up now, the clergy they come in, stand up now, the clergy they come in, stand up now. The clergy they come in and say it is a sin that we should now begin our freedom for to win. Stand up now, diggers all. Gainst lawyers and gainst priests, stand up now, gainst lawyers and gainst priests, stand up now. For tyrants they are both, even flat against their oath, to grant us they are loath, free meat and drink and cloth, stand up now, diggers all. The club is all their law, stand up now, the club is all their law, stand up now. The club is all their law, to keep poor men in awe, but they no vision saw, to maintain such a law, stand up now, diggers all.
This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Finner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton-Bealeton, or WMRW, Warren. Next, a workshop examining the relationship between certain corporate interests and war making. It was titled, Structural Causes of War, the Oil Industry, the Arms Industry, and the New Military-Industrial Complex, and was held at the National Veterans for Peace Convention last August in Seattle. The featured speaker is activist scholar Antonia Juhasz, author of The Bush Agenda. She's introduced by Todd Boyle of Veterans for Peace.
So the purpose of this segment is putting an end to war, and that is by examining the direct causes of war kind of in a mechanical way. And I think putting an end to war is a realistic goal, So the anti-war faction says that at least the last 10 or 20 wars were started by certain organizations of people or forms of organization that we can identify and we can see, and it's pretty blatant. And so we ask just exactly how do we stop these particular, not individuals, but the types of transactions and organization and behavior so that we can stop wars. So the first assertion that I want to make is that the MIC, Military-Industrial Congressional Complex, is a real thing. It is not a Rorschach test where it's a projection of your beliefs or anything like that. And it's not a conspiracy theory that was dreamed up by the Democratic Party to get more votes or anything like that. And it's not a way of looking at things. It's one of the great industrial complexes, I use the term great in the meaning of large, of which we have the telecom industry is sort of the granddaddy of regulatory capture. And we have agribusiness, we have media. Education is also an industry. It has many millions of people. And you have the transportation industry and so on. All of them have a government aspect. They have government protections of their monopoly, you could say, or regulation. And but the military-industrial complex is unique in that it has pretty much won the ball game and it's captured all the revenue. You sort of notice that when you look at the federal budget. And so it has a uniquely large portion of its money coming from someone else besides its own. It doesn't deliver value to anybody. What you really have is a bunch of folks saying, oh, I'll do a favor for you, I'll do a favor for you, and the money rains down from the taxpayers. So it's really kind of an odd industry. So I'm going to say my second assertion really is that the MIC is a cause of war. It's not something that just is a servant of the public or something that we need to have so we'll have a strong defense when the time comes. It's actually a cause of war. And one of the ways in logic and reason that you determine if something's a cause is if you take it away and then the phenomenon disappears after you take it away. Think about that for a while. It hasn't ever been taken away, so you can't prove that it's a cause. But I'll bet you, if you took away the military-industrial complex, you wouldn't have war. As Chalmers Johnson says in all of his speeches, when war is this profitable, you're going to see a lot more of it. The MIC is the cause of a lot of other things besides war. It's mostly about making money for its participants. Corporations, the nature of business is that the costs you don't have to pay that aren't on your expenses are somebody else's cost. And so a company will gladly create $1,000 of useless commotion of any kind. It doesn't matter, any arbitrary thing, any whimsical thing, as long as they can get a dollar of profit. And they can get down the road with that. In fact, you know, 200 years ago, the machines took over most of the physical work. And about 50 years ago and on, the machines took over most of the mental work. Well, what other kind of work is there? There isn't any. 95% of what we're doing is art. We could be laying out in the grass, and the same food would be on our table. It's pathetic. So war is our art, sad to say. So anyway, I define the MIC as a web of economic transactions. I worked for 20 years as a CPA in corporate accounting and finance, and I apologize for this. But what we know in accounting is transactions, and that is reciprocal transactions. People do things for other people for money, and so you have goods and services of all kinds and money. That's the classic element, but more commonly in the MIC is just goods and services in exchange for goods and services, by which I mean patronage and favors. So it's kind of like a big mutual back-scratching thing. Or as Chuck Spinney says in his film Inside the Pentagon, the self-licking ice cream cone. Has anybody seen that? It's a great video. So anyway, a key point I have to make on transactions. In business, transactions have a life cycle that starts with the negotiation and so on, and then there's a contract, there's a commitment, and then there's the fulfillment or the execution of the contract. So a transaction, you think of it as just a transaction, you know, and it takes place at a point in time. That's not how any transactions work. There's a life cycle of transactions, and it's well supported in business software. So what we're trying to do is to get back to those earlier stages of these contracts where it's relatively easy to change them. For example, when corporations need to change their relationships or their transactions relating to a factory, for example, they just budget a couple of years out and they shut that puppy down and everybody's out there and they can't do anything about it and it's over. All right? Or if they want to start up a new industry, they just crank the handle in the investment banking to get the money, start a new industry. This is where you have to be, is at the front end of these relationships in the discussion stage, in the budgeting. In the corporation budget is what I'm talking about, not the federal budget. The federal budget is captured. But corporations are capable of changing. That's all I'm saying. They can change. How to make them change is, I haven't got time. Antonia is the expert on this. She's just taking them apart. Be sure to get out there and read the books, Chalmers Johnson, Antonia's book. And this is a classic here. So with no further ado, Antonia Juhas.
Thanks, Kevin. Hi. I want to thank Todd for all of his wonderful efforts in getting me here. I'm absolutely thrilled to be here. I was just on the phone with my father, who is a vet, telling him that he needed to be here with me. And he's in New Orleans right now working on reconstruction in New Orleans, not with the companies. He's an environmental design architect. Helping with local reconstruction, but so he couldn't be here. But I am absolutely thrilled to be here, so thank you for having me. I am with a group called the Institute for Policy Studies, and it's based in Washington, D.C., but I get to be in San Francisco, so I came up yesterday in the midst of all the hair gel scare to be here from San Francisco, and I'm very, very glad I made it, and my hair gel made it too, so I'm feeling good. I used to work for a group called the International Forum on Globalization for 5 years, and before that I worked for Congress, and I'm part of the military-industrial congressional complex, but I worked for Congressman John Conyers, and thank you. I'll just stay up here, sorry, thanks. And part of my job was working on military issues for Congressman Conyers, which meant battling head-on the military-industrial complex. So it was quite a good position to be in. But also, my work for Congressman Conyers started on domestic social policy, so welfare, job training, health care, social security. This was during the Clinton administration, so what that mostly meant was trying to fight the Clinton welfare reform bill, which meant for our constituents in Detroit, the largest welfare recipient population in the country, that they were all going to be cut off of the rolls. And when we lost, and they were cut off, I received all the individual phone calls from all the women across Detroit who wanted to know what we were going to do to help them now that they couldn't afford to provide food for their children or housing for their families. And needless to say, my policy attention quickly turned to alternatives and the looking for what we could do differently. And that took me to looking at community development block grants, which, to make a long story short, threw me right into the head of an international trade agreement that essentially would make it impossible for us to implement a community development block grant in Detroit. And this made me question what I was doing and say, well, if multinational corporations can just leapfrog us and go to the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development or go to the World Trade Organization or go to these mumbo-jumbo names of organizations that only five people in Washington know what they mean, then how am I going to be able to do the work that I want to do on a domestic level to really help my country? And I decided that what I needed to do was focus on international trade and investment rules and stopping the policies that were being implemented and work towards the implementation of alternatives. What these policies are called in the shorthand is free trade. Sounds really good. Most people in Seattle know more about the ills of free trade than probably most people. But free trade has all the same connotations and wonderful feelings of freedom, but the term is just as misused as freedom is by those who use the term free trade. And what I learned very quickly was that under the guise of so-called free trade, a lot of very brutal and deadly policies were being implemented. So when the Bush administration announced just 10 days after September 11th that it would be countering terror with trade, I knew that something very disturbing was about to take place if I didn't know it before when the Bush administration came into office. And the more I started looking, the more I identified what we're calling the structural causes of war, the structural motivations behind this administration. And the title of my book is The Bush Agenda, Invading the World, One Economy at a Time. It doesn't give the credit to George W. Bush. What it points to is a series of long-term thinking among key political leaders on military and economic ideas that coalesced and have thus far reached their pinnacle during this administration. And therefore, I call it the Bush agenda. But they certainly have no interest in it ending with this administration. It certainly didn't begin with this administration. And what it is unique to the modern era, the coalescing of the overuse of the U.S. military to accomplish a very clear economic agenda. And that economic agenda has everything to do with free trade, but what that free trade means is the interests of the largest multinational corporations, not all multinational corporations, not all U.S. corporations, but a subset that is intimately linked with this administration in a way that, again, is unique in the modern era. And by understanding the links between these specific companies and this administration and this war in Iraq, because now we have more than one war that the United States is involved in, this war in Iraq, the rest of the wars that are happening right now in the Middle East that the U.S. is party to through Israel, and the larger interest through the rest of the Middle East, the better that we can unravel that agenda, stop the war, stop the Bush administration, and stop the incursion of these corporations, which I absolutely 100% believe we can do, and I believe it's the people in this room that are going to have the most effect with that, because as Todd said, I think in the end of the day, it's getting this information more than anything else to potential military recruits, to soldiers that are currently serving in the war, that will shine that light that might not already be lighting, that aha light to say, no way, as if I could quote, Cindy Sheehan on the back of my book, who wrote, all potential military recruits should read this book and then decide if Halliburton and Chevron are worth fighting for. I think that's a pretty simple way of putting it. So I'm going to provide a little bit of this picture. I'm going to talk for a little bit longer, and then we're going to have a lot of time for questions, because I'm going to probably present, I'm hoping that I will present a lot of information that I would hope that we have a discussion about afterwards, particularly targeted towards what we do about it. There are four corporations that I focus on in particular: Bechtel, which is based in San Francisco, which is a family-owned business that traces its history back about 120 years. I'll get back to Bechtel. Bechtel, which is the largest construction and engineering company in the United States and one of the largest in the world. Lockheed Martin. We all know who Lockheed Martin is. Lockheed Martin also happens to have 16 former or current executives who serve in the Bush administration. It's an unqualified umbilical link between one company and the administration. Lockheed Martin, in Todd's chart, the constant revolving door between Lockheed Martin and the current administration is particularly unique and strong, including Vice President Cheney's wife, who served on the board of Lockheed Martin, Lynn Cheney. Then there is Chevron. Chevron is easily forgotten because it's got its big, big daddy, ExxonMobil. And ExxonMobil is very important for us to focus on, given the fact that ExxonMobil over the last 2 years earned the largest profits of any corporation in world history. And that was in 2004 and 2005. In the first quarter of 2006, they earned 34% more than they earned in the same period in 2005, which means that they are set to, I mean, the profits they are about to make are astronomical. And that is part and parcel to what I'm going to talk about, but I focus on Chevron for several reasons, the most important being Chevron's very long and active history in Iraq, and in addition, of course, Ms. Condoleezza Rice, who it is very famously known that Condoleezza Rice has a Chevron oil tanker named after her. It's very less well known that she earned it. She spent 10 years on the board of directors of Chevron, and she was the head of their policymaking committee. She's intimately connected to this corporation, and its interests are intimately connected to her interests. The other company is, of course, Halliburton. And Halliburton's connections to Cheney are obviously well known. But what's less well known is, again, the umbilical link between Halliburton and the Bush administration. Because when Cheney was defense secretary for the prior Bush administration, he left that position to run Halliburton. He took a number of his leading compatriots from the senior Bush administration with him to Halliburton. He also took a tremendous amount of the Pentagon's budget with him and transferred an enormous amount of money that was once in the Pentagon budget that then got privatized into Halliburton's budget. Then when he came back to Bush Jr.'s administration, he again brought an enormous number of his Halliburton officials back into government with him, so that in essence you can see that the Bush administration is sort of a both Bush administrations and Halliburton is just sister cousins to each other as they, you know, open one door and now I'm in the administration and another door and now I'm in the Halliburton headquarters. I picked these four companies because of their link to the Bush administration, but also because of their very long history in Iraq. And by looking at their history in Iraq and then their influence on the various Bush administrations and their influence on what was and then no longer was the Saddam Hussein regime, we understand quite a bit about why we're in Iraq and why we're not getting out yet. These industries, weapons, oil and gas, and engineering are all obviously very intimately connected themselves, and they're a infrastructure hybrid for what the Bush administration needs to carry its economic interests forward around the world. So it needs oil companies, it needs engineering companies, and obviously it needs weapons. But the companies very much need the Bush administration to advance their access to oil, to engineering contracts, to wars in which they can supply lots and lots of weapons. And obviously the two work together. It's not a coincidence that the two work together. So this is the first time in American history that the president, vice president, and secretary of state are all former oil or energy company officials. In fact, both President Bush and Condoleezza Rice have more experience running oil companies than they do working for the government. Bush wasn't very government good at it, but he's not a very good president either. He wasn't hired for his expertise. He was hired for his connections in both cases. And the oil and gas industry has in turn been very, very friendly to the Bush administration. So the oil and gas industry donated 13 times more money to the Bush administration in the 2000 election, 13 times more than their challengers. And in essence, they've gotten what they've paid for, and they is a very relative term in this context, right? They includes the Bush administration, and they includes the oil and gas industry. They have gotten deregulation, the ability to vertically integrate, and you can't underestimate what this means. So the same companies now, because of vertical integration, control exploration of oil, production of oil, refining, marketing, and sales. In fact, the top five oil companies, or is it 10? It's in my book. Guess we're going to have to read my book. Either the top five or 10 largest oil companies in the world, I think it's five, produce more oil every day than Saudi Arabia exports. They control supply, but more important than that, they control refining capacity, which means they control how much oil gets turned into gas. So if you can control that, you can limit the supply of gas, and if you control the marketing and the pricing and the sales, then you can control price. The Bush administration has allowed that consolidation to happen and the deregulation, which allows it to be perpetuated, which increases the profits of its friends. But more importantly, it has fought a war for oil, and I'll explain how that works. But let me jump ahead to let's go a little bit back into the history in Iraq. So Ronald Reagan opened up the door to U.S. economic engagement with Iraq. Part of the initial impetus was to create a buffer in the war with Iran. So Iraq had launched a war against Iran. It was a brutal 8-year-long war. The United States had several interests. One of the interests was that we had had Iran, which had been the U.S. Oil chum in the Middle East after Saudi Arabia. And then Iran, you know, for those of you who are too young to remember, President Carter celebrated New Year's Eve 1977 with the Shah. We had a very nice, cozy relationship. Then there was this pesky revolution in Iran, and the United States got kicked out, and we no longer had that pool of oil. So Iran, the United States was looking for a new Iran, and it was looking to Iraq. So Ronald Reagan provided weapons to Saddam Hussein. He provided intelligence to Saddam Hussein in the war with Iran. And U.S. businesses lobbied aggressively for access into Saddam's market. And they did this through something called the U.S.-Iraq Business Forum, but also through Kissinger Associates. Our friend Kissinger just can't stay out of any modern history of the United States. And Kissinger Associates lobbied very heavily for U.S. businesses in Iraq as well. And those companies involved in that were Bechtel, KBR, part of Halliburton, Chevron, Exxon, you go through the list. George Shultz, who had been the president of Bechtel for 8 years, then became Ronald Reagan's Secretary of State. In that role, he personally lobbied with Saddam Hussein for increased U.S. business access into Iraq. And so did Donald Rumsfeld. The very famous picture of Donald Rumsfeld shaking hands with Saddam Hussein took place when Rumsfeld was Reagan's Middle East envoy, and he was there on behalf of several business interests, including Bechtel. And what the U.S. government wanted was for Saddam Hussein to sign a contract with Bechtel so that Bechtel could build an oil pipeline to get Saddam's oil out through the port of Aqaba, Jordan. While those negotiations were going on, though, Bechtel moved forward with managing a petrochemical complex for Saddam Hussein, which made the precursor to mustard gas, which was clearly used by Saddam Hussein. George Shultz worked very closely with Saddam. U.S. businesses worked very closely with Saddam. I'm going to fast forward through the story just to say they were all there. They were all working with him. They were all making a profit off of him while they could. George Bush Sr. pushed the envelope even farther and worked way more aggressively than Ronald Reagan to increase U.S. economic and corporate ties with Saddam Hussein, trying to get greater and greater access to Iraq's oil in particular, which, in fact, George Bush Sr. Did. He accomplished a tremendous amount of U.S. exports of Iraqi oil, and much of that was done by Chevron. However, Saddam wouldn't really play ball all the way. He wouldn't sign Bechtel's oil pipeline deal. He wouldn't open up his oil to the extent that U.S. companies and the Bush senior administration wanted. And he went ahead and invaded Kuwait. The lack of interest in continuing to work with Saddam Hussein sort of reaches its pinnacle at that point for the Bush administration. I'm not going to debate right now, and we can in questions, did Bush want Saddam to invade Kuwait? Did he let him? Why didn't he take him down afterwards? I'm going to sort of jump forward through that whole discussion because it's a big one and just say he wasn't playing ball with us the way our companies and our political interests wanted.